I'm talking today with the esteemed composer Samuel Adler, whose 60-plus year career has touched on just about every important musician, including, well, of course, Samuel Adler, sitting here in the studio with me today, introducing his music and sharing stories of his life with us in celebration of your 90th birthday, which took place this past Sunday. We're going to play three tracks now, and two of them related to Hanukkah. I just wanted to play some music by your dad because he had such a huge influence on your life, as we've heard. And also from your first teacher, Herbert Fromm, your composition teacher, also a composer.
Yes.
So you're going to have to help me with the pronunciation because I'm not that good at
it. My father's is Hanerot Halalu, which means the lights that we have kindled, and the other one is Miya Malel, which is a Hanukkah madrigal based on an actual folk tune.
Okay.
Who can retell this story?
And we're going to also play A Prophecy of Peace, which is your piece.
The Prophecy of Peace is based on the Torah chant, the chant with which the Bible is read, or the Hebrew first five books are read in the synagogue. It uses the what we call the trope of the actual cantillation, and is a very famous prophecy of peace by the prophet Micah. It shall come to pass in the end of days, and you will hear the text in English, so it's easy to
beat their swords into plowshares.
And they sing it beautifully. It's the chorus is the
Gloria Dei Cantores. Cantoris Ensemble.
Right.
Didn't you say that they sent you flowers for your birthday?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
We are very close. They've recorded a whole album of my choral music. I've written an ecumenical mass for them, actually, for the opening of their Romanesque cathedral where are they? In Orleans, Massachusetts.
Right, yeah.
Yes.
Okay, music by Hugo Adler and by Herbert Fromm and by Samuel Adler, my guest today here on FM 91. Dei Cantores Ensemble performing music by Samuel Adler. We heard A Prophecy of Peace, and before that, two tracks from the Milken Archive of American Jewish Music. We began with a Hanukkah piece for the lighting of the candles by Samuel Adler's father, Hugo Adler, and after that, we heard Herbert Fromm's Hanukkah Madrigal. Herbert Fromm was an early teacher, the first composition teacher, in fact, of Samuel Adler. Samuel Adler is my guest today on Afternoon Classics. We are spending the entire afternoon with him on the occasion of his 90th birthday, which took place a few days ago. He was in Dallas then, a city that he spent a lot of time with early in his career, living and teaching there. But Sam, after Dallas, you went to Boston, or you went, well, no, let me rewind, because we're going back to your college years,
right.
Okay? You know, I read this book, and I'm trying to keep it all straight in my head.
But you shouldn't do that.
There's a lot of stories to tell in this book, and I want to get to as many of them as we can. But, okay, so you were in Worcester. You grew up in Worcester, and then you went to Boston Conservatory.
No, Boston University.
Boston University in Boston. There is a difference. Yeah,
there is.
I know. I took classes at
Boston Conservatory.
Yeah. So you went to Boston University, and what was your experience there? You were studying to be a composer there, or were you conducting?
No, I was studying to be a violinist, as a matter of fact, and the composer. So I was a double major, violin and composition. And it was a wonderful time to go to college, because this was 1946. And in 1946, all the GIs were coming back from the wars, and they were being paid by the government, you know, through the GI Bill to go to school. And they demanded standards. And before then, during the war, it was kind of a lax standard. People went to school or didn't go to school, but these were people who wanted to become professionals, and they needed high standards in order to compete. Yeah. And many of them were much older. I was the baby of the—I was the only non-GI that went to school during January 1946. And, of course, everybody loved me and treated me wonderfully, but they were like my parents rather than like my classmates.
Right.
And we had an orchestra that was excellent because of all these older guys. And, however, the conductor, who was a wonderful musician, a cellist in the Boston Symphony, was our conductor. He didn't care about conducting. So he wanted to do one piece for a whole semester. And we did one of my favorite pieces. But to do it, the Schumann First Symphony for the whole semester, I mean, we could play it after two rehearsals.
Right.
So we decided to form our own orchestra and really do repertoire, especially composers who lived in the area. So we did a concert at Jordan Hall. The orchestra was called the Intercollegiate Symphony Orchestra.
Yeah. So it came from other colleges.
Oh, yes, we had New England Conservatory, Boston Conservatory, Harvard people, but mostly from Boston University because we wanted to play other music. So we did a concert of all Boston composers, including Piston and Randall Thompson and, you know, the composers everybody knew in Boston. Lucas Foss was there. And we did these composers, and it was a tremendous success. We had especially a big article in the Christian Science Monitor, which was a very influential paper at that time in Boston. And because of the success of the concert, we did a second concert. And this time, we featured the music of Lucas Foss. And he was the soloist. He played his first piano concerto. We did his first symphony and a work called Recordare. Yeah. Wonderful pieces. Very exciting. And, of course, he was a fabulous pianist. And the Boston papers went mad about this great new orchestra that was doing all this.
Yeah. But this got Monday, you in trouble, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
On Monday after the second performance, I was called into the dean's office and said, "What are you doing here? You are to play in this orchestra and be quiet." I said, "Well, I'm playing in this orchestra. We're all playing in this orchestra here at Boston University, but we want orchestral experience. So we formed our own orchestra." He said, "Yes, but right now you're going to disform your orchestra and let everybody go because we will not permit this kind of competition. And you're either a student here or you go out, and from now on, you are no more a student here." So I was kicked out of the school.
Wow.
Well, I had many friends, and everybody in the orchestra went to rehearsal but stayed outside of the room.
Mm-hmm.
And the conductor came and said, "What's going on?" I said, "Well, we're here to play, but we will only play if Sam is reinstated as a student." So that was a wonderful thing to do. And I was reinstated as a student. We discontinued the orchestra, I'm sorry to say. But
what a fantastic story. You know, not the first time they tried to kick you out.
Well, the second time was because of chorus.
Yeah.
We had a choral conductor who, he actually was a voice teacher, but he was a choral conductor at Boston University. Dr. Houghton was his name.
Yeah.
Anyway, he did two works a year. At Christmas, of course, the Messiah. At Easter, either the Creation or the Elijah. Well, those are three of my favorite pieces. But as choral people, we wanted to sing, you know, Bach motets and Schubert and Mendelssohn and Brahms and Debussy and so on and so forth. So we formed our own chorus. We gave, again, two concerts of music from Marchaux to Millau.
Mm.
And people loved it, and we had a wonderful time doing it.
Well, you
However,
got dragged into the office again.
Monday morning after the second concert, the same story. Well, this time, I'm sorry to say, we just discontinued having a chorus on the side. And the dean said to me, you do one more thing and you'll never come into this school.
Wow.
Well, that was a warning.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I was a bad boy.
Yeah, you didn't pay attention to that,
you see, the composition teacher, a very good musician and a very good composer in the 19th century style, wanted us all to write in the style of Mendelssohn. Well, Mendelssohn is one of my favorite composers, but I don't want to write in the style of Mendelssohn.
Yeah.
So he found out I was accepted at Harvard as a graduate student, and that did not go down well. Mm-hmm. He wanted me, I'm the only teacher that can teach you anything, because over there they're teaching all this music that doesn't make sense, that doesn't have any tonality, and you should stay here. So he flunked me.
Well, he was trying to mess with your getting into Harvard. Yeah.
This time, I was kicked out, and my father was told about it and was asked to come to school.
Hmm.
Well, we settled on something. I had one more summer before going to graduate school, and Dr. Norden said, okay, if you write 6 pieces in the style of Mendelssohn this summer, I will give you a grade so that you can pass. I did this. I almost had a nervous breakdown.
Right.
But 6 pieces, I wrote them in the style of Mendelssohn. Not as good as Mendelssohn, but in the style. And I did graduate.
Yeah.
So that's the
story.
You
got an A, right?
I did.
On that.
No, no.
No, you got an A on the Mendelssohn pieces.
F and A.
Yeah.
A for the Mendelssohn pieces, F for the semester, which became a B minus.
But you still got into Harvard.
I passed.
Yeah. You paid your Mendelssohn tax.
Yeah.
You got into Harvard.
Well, actually, I did some Mendelssohn things. For instance, I put out a new edition of his 115 Psalm, one of the great masterpieces, which was only published in Latin, and I made an English translation out of it, and there were some mistakes in the orchestral parts, and now it can be done correctly.
We're going to talk about your Harvard years and some of the great stories you have to tell about that, but first I want to play some more music. This is from 1953, originally from 1953. You revised it in the 1960s. Your string quartet number 3. Did you write this? Were you out of the Army by then, or were you
still? Yes.
Okay.
This was written
53.
Very closely after the Army. But I have a story to tell about that. It was written for my friends, a quartet of the Dallas Symphony, first chair people. And they liked my symphonies and orchestral pieces. By that time, I had written an overture called Summer Stock for the orchestra, and they said, why don't you write us a string quartet? And I had already written 2 string quartets, which I'm happy to say do not exist anymore. And so this was the 3rd, and it was published as the 3rd quartet, so I let musicologists worry about how many quartets I've written. But this 3rd quartet was written for them. They played it several times, also in New York, and it got a tremendous write-up in the New York Times. However, when I heard it again after a year, I really didn't like it. And I completely rewrote it 10 years later. Mm. And now
You're okay with it.
I am okay with that.
But if we go looking for quartets number 1 and 2...
There ain't no such thing.
We're not going to find them.
No.
We're going to hear the 3rd and 4th movement, the 2 final movements from the string quartet number 3. This is music of Samuel Adler, my guest today, performed by the Meliora Quartet here on FM 91. Music of Samuel Adler. We heard the final 2 movements from the string quartet number 3. That was the Meliora Quartet. Sam Adler is here with me today. We're listening to his music, talking about stories from his life. Sam, when I hear that music, I can't help but think that string players just love to dig their bows into into those notes?
Well, since I was a string player, I loved to write for strings, and I loved to write the things I used to love to play.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, growing up in Worcester, Massachusetts, first of all, I had a very good violin teacher mm-hmm. who was typical of that time. He had a daily radio show from 12 noon to 12:30 on a local radio station with a trio, violin, cello, and piano. And he played, you know, dinner music. I mean, very nice, lovely music of mostly the 19th century, and some popular tunes, etc. And he was a very strict teacher. He was a member of the New York Philharmonic who had to leave because of his wife's illness. Mm-hmm. She couldn't be in New York, so they moved to Worcester. And he became the number one violin teacher there and also was concertmaster of the Philharmonic and had this radio program every day. So that was one thing. Then we had a high school. I went to high school at Classical High School in Worcester, which I'm sorry to say doesn't exist anymore. But during my years in high school, I was there 3.5 years. We could accelerate in those days. I had 3.5 years of theory.
In high school.
An excellent theory teacher who was the conductor of the orchestra. And he was a graduate of the Mozarteum in Salzburg and had studied there with Bruno Walter and people like that.
Wow.
And he was from New Jersey, but he had done work overseas. He became the music teacher, the instrumental music teacher at Classical High School, and he was very lazy. He was a terrific conductor, but very lazy. So I had to conduct every day. I had to conduct every rehearsal. He conducted the concert. I did every rehearsal. Huh. What an amazing
experience.
Education.
Yeah.
Imagine. And he's tearing me to pieces every day. But that's how to learn.
Right.
It was terrific. Then after the freshman year, he said, okay, Adler, I want you to write an orchestra piece for the orchestra every semester. So I wrote 2 orchestra pieces a year, none of which exist anymore, but I thought, of course, they were masterpieces.
Yeah.
But that's okay. They played it, and I conducted them, and what an experience. And this was in high school.
Yeah.
Plus, we had 3.5 years of music history.
That music went the way of your first 2 string quartets.
Yeah. First 2 string quartets were written for my high school buddies.
Yeah.
I realized after a little while how bad they were, but it was unfortunately after the 3rd quartet had been published.
Mm.
And so I let musicologists wonder why there is a number 10 but not number 1 and 2.
Well, you know, they just listen to this program. They'll figure it out.
That's it.
Sure.
That's it.
You mentioned your amazing high school education in music, and you and I were talking during the music about the state of music education today, and I know you have strong feelings about it, and
yes.
I'm wondering if you would share that with us.
Well, I think some music programs are really excellent. For instance, my wife Emily last year conducted the All-State Texas String Orchestra.
Mm.
Well, I'll tell you, Brad, you cannot get better players than that. And they are all over. Our country is producing fantastic players. But I'm afraid that we think too much that they ought to be schooled in popular music. And that's really not necessary. Let them be schooled in classical music, and they can play popular music. Listen, when I was a kid, I played a lot of popular music. You don't need to go to school for that.
Yeah.
But you need to learn the Western idea of what music is, and the Eastern idea, because you know now the competition is coming from China and Japan and Taiwan and Korea and so on, where they're turning out the most fantastic musicians.
Yeah.
You know that the Juilliard School has just built a new school in China, which is opening next fall, and they're going to teach the Juilliard method to graduate students, teachers, and pre-college, so that if the students come to America, they'll be well prepared.
Yeah. It's hard to get that message out. in this country, because, you know, like all arts organizations, I mean, there's not a lot of support from various municipalities.
Right.
It's hard to get folks on that bandwagon and you know, show them the importance of a traditional musical education. But I like to think that even institutions like WGTE, radio stations, professional symphonies are filling the gap a little bit. Toledo Absolutely. Symphony with their school, right? Would you agree with that?
Yes, and it also depends on the teacher. If the teacher is excited about good music, it'll be good music in the schools.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example that I always love, and I love to tell the story. My youngest daughter, Naomi, always loved to sing. And from the third, fourth, fifth grade on, she sang in every choral group that was in the school. And in high school, she sang in everything from the jazz choir to the big choir, with everything in between, madrigal group, etc. Well, in high school, they had a music teacher who was very successful as an arranger of pop tunes. And that is all they did, from the jazz choir to the big choir, all of this kind of stuff. Well, her third year, she decided she wanted to go to Interlaken. And in Interlaken, they had, and I'm sure they still have, a fantastic choral program. And she was singing Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, Schubert, Brahms, Debussy, Poulenc, etc., Hindemith, Chanson, and so on. Well, she came back, and back into her last year and singing all this pop stuff.
Mm.
Well, she went to her teacher and said, Mr. So-and-so, I won't mention the name because he's quite famous, actually,
okay,
as an arranger. Couldn't we, for my birthday, could we sing Ave Verum Corpus of Mozart? Well, I'm sure many of your listeners know it, and you certainly know it.
Sure.
And it is one of the most moving pieces. Well, he said, I don't know it. So she said, my daddy has a copy, I'll bring it. So he Xeroxed the copy and reluctantly did it.
Yeah.
Well, without my daughter signing it, but everybody in the big choir signed a letter to him saying, this was the best experience we've had in chorus. Couldn't we do more of this music? You see, kids have good taste.
Yeah.
If they do a piece by Mozart or a piece by Beethoven or a piece by Debussy or Poulenc or Hindemith, they know the worth. And it is much better than doing pop music, which they can't do as well as on television.
Yeah.
So you listen to it on television is enough.
Sometimes it's just a matter of exposure.
Of course.
And we try to expose people to a lot of different types of music,
sure,
within the classical canon here.
Yes,
on,
I mean,
the
look,
radio.
There are plenty of radio stations on the air that do the other kind. Thank God there's one that doesn't.
Yeah. Well, I'm speaking with Samuel Adler, the composer, the conductor, the author, the teacher, and he has a book out called Building Bridges with Music, Stories from a Composer's Life. We're talking about some of those stories today. Also a new 3-CD set of his music, ranging from the 1950s through the 2000s. It's called One Lives But Once, a 90th birthday celebration. Sam Adler had his 90th birthday this past Sunday. And I want to talk about your Harvard years. So you left Boston University, you went to Harvard, and you studied with some pretty big names there.
Well, the first one I studied with was Walter Piston, who was the composer in residence, actually, at Harvard at that time. He was a very strange teacher. Because
you tell a story about the first piece you wrote for him that he didn't like it.
Yeah. Well, he assigned. You see, in those days, now when we have composition, we have lessons. We have private lessons. In those days, the whole class was there, and there were 15 of us, and he called on us, and he gave us an assignment. The first assignment was to write a theme and variations for piano. Well, I was a hotshot composer in those days. I wrote a piece for piano, a theme, and seven variations. I came in, and he was as bad a pianist as I. He played the right hand, I played the left hand, and we hacked through the piece. And he was smoking his pipe as usual, and he turned to me and said, "You know, Adler, this is a very nice piece. It sounds like a cross between Leroy Anderson and Morton Gould on their worst days." Well, I was so shocked, I couldn't. I mean, okay, these were popular composers at the time, but I wasn't too much in love with them at that time. I changed my mind since. But anyway, because they were very successful and wrote good music, actually. Yeah. But I was quite put down. I went home and I just couldn't write anything. Well, he called me. He called on me the next week, and I said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Piston, I have nothing." "Okay, fine." He called on me the second week, and I still had nothing. And he said, "Adler, why don't you wait after class?" And he said, "What's wrong with you? I mean, we didn't take you because you were some kind of a genius in harmony and counterpoint. We took you because you wrote a lot of music in your undergraduate years. What's happening?" So I said, "Well, Mr. Piston, I wrote a piece I thought was quite good, theme and seven variations, and you didn't like it." He said, "What do you mean I didn't like it?" So I said, "Well, you said it was like a cross between Leroy Anderson and Morton Gould on their worst days." And he said, he looked at me and said, "What's wrong with them? They're making lots of money." So that's Piston taught by sarcasm mostly. But you learned because you studied his music, which was extraordinary and still is.
Well, I want to play some more music now. And after that, I want to talk about Paul Hindemith. Also, the great story you tell about Igor Stravinsky Masterclass, which everybody needs to hear. And we'll also talk a little bit about Aaron Copland, a wonderful, poignant story that you have to do with him. But let's hear this piano quintet. Can you put this in context for us?
Well, that's written late. I was asked to write a piano quintet. Mm-hmm. This recording is especially a favorite of mine because Jerry Lowenthal, who was on the faculty with me at the Juilliard School, one of the great American pianists, said I would love to play it. And he recorded it with a quartet of wonderful players, not a constituted quartet, but one put together for the purpose of recording this piece.
Okay. And they call themselves the Esterhazy Quartet.
The Esterhazy Quartet was the put. They were a constituted quartet, but the first performance was by a quartet of friends of mine, players from different symphony orchestras. Okay. The recording is by an excellent quartet, the Esterhazy Quartet, which is at the University of Missouri in Columbia. And has been together for over 40 years.
Okay.
And for their 40th anniversary, they played my 8th and 9th string quartet and asked me to write, they played my 7th and 8th string quartet and asked me to write a 9th string quartet for them. And the recording is of the 8th and the 9th and with Jerry Lowenthal as the piano quintet.
Yeah, you've written a lot of chamber music for strings.
Oh, yes.
Quartets and quintets.
Yeah. Oh, and trios, all kinds of things. And, you know, I have a series, we may play a couple of pieces from that later on, of cantos, which are pieces for single instruments.
Yeah.
But we can hear the piano quintet first.
This is Samuel Adler's piano quintet from the aforementioned Esterhazy Quartet. They're joined by pianist Jerome Lowenthal here on FM 91. Piece ends with that sonorous depth to it. We heard the piano quintet by Samuel Adler. That was the Esterhazy Quartet, along with pianist Jerome Lowenthal. Samuel Adler is in the studio with me today. We are playing his music, and we're going to talk some more stories from his book, Building Bridges with Music, and listen to some more of his recordings coming up momentarily. But before that, I want to let you know that you are listening to Public Radio FM 91, WGTE FM Toledo, WGLE Lima, WGDE Defiance, WGBE Bryan, and online at WGTE.org. We're spending the afternoon with composer Samuel Adler, who celebrated his 90th birthday this past Sunday, listening to cuts from his discography, which is quite extensive, of course, with many, many decades of writing experience behind him. Also a new recording called One Lives But Once, a 90th birthday celebration, and we're going to sample that a little bit more. But before we do that, I want to hear some more stories from this wonderful book of yours, Sam. And if we go back to your Harvard years, you talk about studying with Walter Piston. We heard how, you know, the little misunderstanding that you had at the very beginning with him. Then you also studied with Paul Hindemith. And I love the picture you paint of Hindemith saying, if you want to write a piece of music, picture the musicians that are going to play it, right, and imagine them playing it. And that was a way to get you going.
Well, that was wonderful advice. And it happened this way, that he made you write a new piece for every lesson. That means a complete piece, not 2 measures or 10 measures or 50 measures, but a complete piece. Well, of course, I had a lot of old pieces, and for the first 6 weeks, I brought in old pieces, which he ripped up and told me how terrible they were. And then he would rewrite them in his style, and they all sounded like Battista Mahler, you know, one of the great masterpieces of the 20th century. And pretty soon you learned how to do that, but for some time I just couldn't write anything. So I came to him and I said, "Oh, Mr. Hindemith, I have writer's block." He threw me out. I called in sick for the next lesson because I just couldn't write anything else. Well, the lesson after that, I went in and I said, "Mr. Hindemith, please don't get angry at me. I need some help. I just don't." And he said, "Well, how do you write?" So I said, "Well, I sit down at my desk," because, you see, if you said, "I sit down at the piano," he would say, "You shouldn't sit down at the piano. You should hear it beforehand."
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I said, "I sit down at my desk and I start, you know, copying a little here and there and sketching." He said, "How boring." I won't put on his accent, but he said, "How boring. The way you write is like this. Well, you're a fiddle player," he said. "You know, Yasha Heifetz, he stands there with the violin up and it's wonderful. All of a sudden, you get a phone call from Yasha Heifetz. Sam, I want you to write a sonata for me. I'm giving a Carnegie Hall recital next week. I want a piece of yours." He hangs up. Now, you have two choices. You could say, "Well, I have writer's block. I can't do it." Or you write it. Yeah. And of course you write it. And you see Heifetz, as we just said, holding his violin up. Now, what do you want to come out of that violin first thing? And he sang, "Do, do, dee, do, dee, dee, do, dee." You write down, then you hear again, "Dee, da, 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 da," and so on. And you write down each phrase that you hear him play.
Yeah.
And by the time an hour is over, you have a piece.
So he wanted you to engage your visual imagination
as
well.
That's right. You want to see what's coming out. And you know, I have not written a piece for anybody. I write for people or for groups that ask me. And I always ask them to send me either a tape or a CD or even a video if they have one, so that I can see what the musical personality is like.
Yeah.
Usually I know something about their regular personality, but that doesn't really matter. It's the musical personality, and that has turned me on to write music,
yeah.
And that was a tremendous help.
Interesting. So many wonderful stories in this book, and, you know, if we had 6 hours, I would ask you about all of them. But I do want you to mention, because it's so funny, this occasion of the Igor Stravinsky masterclass.
Masterclass with Igor Stravinsky.
Yeah.
Well, of course, you can imagine, here we are, graduate students, 15 of us in a class, and Walter Piston comes in and says, "Gentlemen, next week we're going to have a guest, Igor Stravinsky. Well, I mean, excuse me, it's like a demigod coming on, God himself coming in. Anyway, we were very excited, and of course, he wanted to see our music. So there were actually six in the class that wrote exactly in his style. And one of the best was Carl Cohn, who became a very well-known composer. He taught at Pomona College for all of his career. And he wrote very much in the Hindemith style. In the Stravinsky style. The others of us were in the Hindemith style, and we didn't want Stravinsky to get angry. So we wanted him to see a typical Stravinsky-like piece because we loved him so.
Right.
Okay. So Carl had just written a sonata for himself and his wife for two pianos, and he said, Carl, you put it up, and Stravinsky will look at it, and he'll love it. Well, the day came, Stravinsky comes in. You know, he was a very short man.
Yeah.
Had a very big head, but a very small body. So we all stood up and clapped, and he said, sit down, gentlemen. So he went to the piano, and he wore very thick glasses, and he wiggled them up and down, looking at the piece. And after a few seconds, he said, it's very hot in here. Open the window. He looked at it again. And he said, oh, I'm getting cold. Close the window. Then he took another look at the piece, quiet. Said, you know, Walter, it's getting very hot in here. Open the window. After an interminable 1 minute, he said, I'm getting a draft. Close the window. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And he walked out. That was the master class with Stravinsky.
And after that, everybody said everybody studied with
Stravinsky. And that reminds me of another story, because I studied with Aaron Copland at Tanglewood the summer after this happened, actually. And he once said to me, you know, Sam, I've had more students than anybody else. I said, that can't be, because you only have 8 students in the summer at Tanglewood. So you can't really have, I mean, I've had lots of classes. He said, no, I've had more students than anybody else, because I tell you, I go to many colleges and I speak to all the music students, maybe 500. And after I finish my talk, everybody puts into his biography, studied with Aaron Copland.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure they did the same thing with you. People listening to this radio broadcast can say that afterwards.
I have had a lot of students.
Yeah. You mentioned Aaron Copland, one of your teachers, and there's just a wonderful story in your book about Aaron Copland. You were asking him for a recommendation as a composer, but he demurred and said he wanted to recommend you as a conductor, that you had to be a conductor. And then years later, he came back and changed his mind.
Well, I have to tell that the beginning of the story was that he did not like my pieces as a student and actually almost refused to take me as a student, and with little manipulation on the part of my Harvard mentor, Irving Fine, he finally took me as a student, reluctantly. But it turned out that after studying with him and after developing as a composer after the Army, he came as a visitor to the University of North Texas, where I was teaching. And as we were driving from Dallas to Denton, he said, you know, Sam, when you were a student at Tanglewood, I told you I couldn't give you a recommendation because I thought you were such a good conductor, you should become a conductor. But now I've heard your first and second symphony and your first opera, the Outcasts of Poker Flat, and I think you really are a composer. Mm-hmm. So he took out a letter and gave it to me. I didn't need it anymore. I'm happy to say that I didn't need the recommendation, but I keep it as a keepsake for somebody who did not believe in me at first, then started to believe.
He came around, yeah. And somebody of the stature of Aaron Copland. And the fact
actually, I have to say, with all the great teachers I've had, Copland was the very best, because he had an insight into the music that was immediate. And he said, look, I think this chord is out of place, or this melody should be at least two measures longer. Now, Hindemith would say that, except he would put in the chord, or he would put in the next two measures. Copland said, you go home and you fix it. And you learn more that way than if a great composer puts the answer, so you take the answer. And so Copland had a great influence on me in aesthetics, because he was able to state what is what he felt was beautiful and what is not beautiful. And also, he did not impose his, not only his aesthetics, but also his style on anybody. And certainly the Copland style was
prevailed
everything in those days, and I was very much influenced by it.
Well, you graduated Harvard in 1950, right, I believe?
And correct.
The same year that you were entered the Army.
The same day.
The same day.
I was drafted.
You were drafted into the Army the same day.
I got my diploma and my draft notice the same day.
Well, I just want you to talk a little bit about the band that you formed in the Army, the 7th Army Symphony Orchestra, which was a remarkable...
which some people did call Sammy's little 7th Army Symphony Orchestra band.
And the connection to General Eisenhower at the time, that's an amazing story.
It was this way, that I was stationed... we were trained in Texas for 6 months and then sent overseas. I was in the 2nd Armored Division, and we were stationed in a very small town in the Pfalz, which is Palatinate in Germany. And this small town was overrun by soldiers because it had 3,600 people in it and 24,000 troops in the base. And... so our general called our pastors, our chaplains, and said, you know, you have a boy there that speaks the language. He's the conductor of the chapel choir. Have him go into town and get somebody as an accompanist for the choir on Sunday afternoons. And I did that, and I found a woman in the Catholic church that was the organist, and she came to play for us our rehearsals. And when she came to the rehearsal, she saw what I could do with the choir. And she said, couldn't you do something for the town? The Germans were here. The French were here. The Americans are here now. They all destroyed the town. Nobody ever did anything for the town. So I said, look, let's form a civic choir. And I said, well, let's get the Catholic and the Protestant choir, church choirs together. So, no, we can't do that. We don't communicate. You know, it was still fighting the 30-year war, you know. But we got them to do it. I took the Catholic and the chief Protestant chaplain down to see the priest and the minister. And for the first time since the 30-year war, they actually talked, because we gave them coffee and tea and so on and so forth. And it was easy. So the two choirs came together, and we had... we started out 40 people at the first rehearsal. The second rehearsal, we had 100 because everybody loved it. And we did the Messiah for Christmas, because in Germany, they don't do the Messiah. That's an English-speaking piece at Christmas. They do other Christmas pieces, some of them as great as the Messiah, like the Christmas Oratorio of Bach. But anyway, we did parts of the Messiah. And interestingly, the Palatinate Orchestra asked me to conduct them. And I said, I will, but I can't accept any money. But for that, you come and play for the Messiah. And that was great. Afterwards, we didn't know, but the German, like the AP in America, the German AP had an article in every major newspaper, and it was entitled, Buchenwald and Dresden Were Forgotten, and had about this concert, Germans and Americans together. You know, we had a German chorus singing in German. We had GI soloists singing in English and the orchestra playing the universal language. Well, our general called me in that morning and said, what's going on? The headquarters called me. They're going crazy about this wonderful thing. You've got to have another concert next week. I said, well, sir, I I can't do that. I said, why don't Easter? Well, we did the same thing. And this time, there were four Americans playing chamber music throughout Germany, all in the army, the four Americans. And they wanted to play in the orchestra because our special services said, we've got to find out what this guy is doing. So they played, and we did a mixed concert, chorus, orchestra, and so on and so forth. And the pianist of this group played the Greek concerto. Mm-hmm. I wanted him to play the Rhapsody in Blue, but he wanted to play the Greek concerto. Afterwards, we went out to have a beer, and they said, Sam, what are you trying to do? And I said, look, we've got to have better relations with the Germans. And the way we could do it is to form an army orchestra and play their music and our music, and they will see that we have a great culture. He said, you think we could do it? I said, everybody's being drafted from all the orchestras. They'd rather come here than go fight in Korea or fight on the eastern frontier. So the next day, they went back to special services. And the next day, I got a call from special services saying, you really think this is an... I said, you let me have carte blanche and I'll get an orchestra together.
Wow.
And that's how it happened. And well, the first concert we played, after a month of learning 100 pieces in a month, we played a farewell concert for General Eisenhower, who was going to America as the president of Columbia University and then became, as we all know, president of the United States. And afterwards he came back to the green room and said, Corporal, that's what was my rank. That was just the greatest thing. It's the best thing psychologically that has been happening here in Europe. But I don't like the uniform you're wearing. I said, well, I'm wearing an Ike jacket, sir. I mean, that's the uniform we all wear. He said, yes, but a conductor shouldn't wear that uniform. You come to my office tomorrow, and I have my tailor make a uniform for you. I went to his office, and he had his tailor make two white general uniforms with corporal stripes.
Wow.
And that's what I wore for the rest of my tour.
Yeah, and your successors wore that uniform,
yes,
too.
Yes, until the orchestra actually became a regular part of the army. Then they made a special uniform for the conductor.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on so we can get to the next piece of music, which has to do with the early 1960s. You were in Dallas, and we talked about Dallas earlier and played some of the music that you wrote and had performed by the Dallas Symphony at that time. But this, of course, is 1963, November, the Kennedy assassination. Right. You were in Dallas. Mm-hmm. You not only were in Dallas, but in the book I read that you lived right across from Love Airfield, and you saw the plane where Johnson was taking the oath.
That's correct. I came back from a doctoral exam at the University of North Texas, and I went home, because everything was canceled, and I saw the plane. And at that moment, when I went by, LBJ was sworn in by Judge Hughes, whom I happened to know.
Yeah.
And I went home, and next day, Donald Johannes, who was the conductor of the Dallas Symphony at that time, called me and he said, can you write something for next Thursday's concert? And this was on Friday, I believe. And I wrote a piece called Requiescat in Pace, which has a Gregorian chant from the Catholic Church, a hymn from the Protestant Church, and a chant from the Jewish tradition in it, and it's for orchestra, and the Dallas Symphony played it the week after the assassination.
Wow. How long did it take you to write it?
3 days.
Because
it had to be written in three days, and the man came to copy the parts. That was great.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to it. This is a poem for symphony orchestra, Requiescat in Pace by Samuel Adler, his wife, Emily Freeman Brown, at the podium with the Bowling Green Philharmonia here on FM 91. Thank you. Music by Samuel Adler, written for the concert that was given in Dallas a week after the assassination of President Kennedy back in 1963, Memorial Concert, which Samuel Adler wrote in just a period of days, drawing together music and musical traditions of different faiths into that piece. It's called Requiescat in Pace. We heard the Bowling Green Philharmonia, directed by Emily Freeman Brown. Samuel Adler here in the studio with me today. We are celebrating his 90th birthday with stories from his book called Building Bridges with Music. And pretty much all the music that we've heard today in one way or the other is building a bridge from one community to the other. And you've made an entire lifetime out of that pursuit.
Well, I think the next piece is a real bridge. Two prayers put together, all on the same theme of giving peace to the world. The Agnus Dei, the final movement from the Catholic Mass, which ends Dona Nobis Pacem, give us peace, and a Jewish prayer called Grant Us Peace, Your Most Precious Gift. And when the Gloria Dei Cantoris people asked me to write an ecumenical mass for the opening of their cathedral in Orleans, Massachusetts, I ended, of course, with this piece, which is, as far as I'm concerned, another bridge between the two religions.
Okay. Well, let's hear it, and we'll come back and we'll talk some more. This is Agnus Dei of Samuel Adler, performed by Gloria Dei Cantoris here on FM 91. Agnus Dei by Samuel Adler, performed by the Gloria Dei Cantoris Ensemble. Sam Adler is here in the studio with me today. We're celebrating his 90th birthday, listening to his music. And Sam, I hope you permit me to say that was just a ravishing choral piece.
Thank
really
you.
Beautiful. And a little note at the end, a little augmentation going on in perhaps the organ, I'm not quite sure, but there was a little bit of a question mark there. And I find that to be flowing through all of your music. When you express beauty, you also kind of temper it a little bit with kind of a question mark. Is that
a
fair assessment?
Well, it does end on a major chord.
Well, it does. It does. We know which side wins.
But, yeah.
But it always seems to be a little bit more complex than what you may expect it to be.
That's right.
Yeah. Sam Adler, as I mentioned, turned 90 years old this past Sunday, and there is a book of his life called Building Bridges with Music, something he's been doing for many decades now, Stories from a Composer's Life. We'll link to that on our website at WGTE.org. We're also sampling a recent CD release called One Lives But Once, a 90th birthday celebration. Music from the 1950s through the 2000s on this 3-CD set, all of it magnificently recorded. And we heard that piece that you wrote in memoriam to President Kennedy back in 1963. You related the story of living close to Love Field and sitting in your car and seeing Air Force One at the time that Johnson was taking the oath after the assassination. And I want to fast forward to 2001 because it's also a remarkable story that on 9/11, which happens to be one of your daughter's birthdays, I know.
Oh, it's my oldest daughter's birthday.
You were actually sitting in an airplane at LaGuardia Airport waiting to take off, and you turned around and had to go back to the gate.
Right, waiting to go home. I was teaching for 19 years at the Juilliard School, commuting from our home in Toledo to New York every week. And it happened to be going back on 9/11. We were on the tarmac. We actually saw there was a fire. And the pilot said there's a fire at the
World Trade Center.
World Trade Center. But we're going to take off. Well, 2 minutes later, he came on. We're going back. It's more than a fire. We didn't know what to do, but immediately they said we had to evacuate the terminal. Happily, I went to a motel right next door and got a room and stayed there overnight. And Then the next day, I stayed at Juilliard. They have in the dorm, they have some studio apartments, and mm-hmm. they did have a room for me. Then I went to my youngest daughter's house, which was just little upstate New York, and finally took a bus home.
Wow, yeah.
I didn't want to write anything about 9/11. However, I did actually for the New York Chamber Orchestra, but we won't play that right now.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I mean, a lot of composers did pour out their reactions, but I imagine it was so visceral for you. Yeah. A lot of wonderful stories in this book, and we don't have time to talk about all of them or to touch on all the music that we want to play today. But one thing that I do want to play is not necessarily your music, but your orchestration of a piano piece by Beethoven, which I just have to say, and I told you this story before we got on the air. Back in the early 1990s, I was kind of obsessed with learning how to write for the orchestra. I thought I would do some composing, and I picked up this book that proved to be very helpful. It was called The Study of Orchestration. And honestly, Sam, only this morning I put two and two together and realized that you were the author of that book.
That's
that
correct.
I had studied so diligently in the 90s and played the examples on the CD. And so I knew you before I actually knew you. At least I knew your writing.
Well, that book has really taken off, and I'm very pleased with it. We're now in its fourth edition, and now we're living in the 21st century, and no longer do we have CDs, but we are streaming all the examples to everybody's computer.
Yeah, wonderful. And so we're going to hear an orchestration that you did for on commission from Stefan Sanderling of The Seven Variations on God Save the King, which was also or is also the melody for the national anthem of Liechtenstein.
That's right, and where he is now the conductor.
Yeah. And what I found remarkable about this, sitting in the audience hearing it at its Toledo Symphony premiere, was that you took Beethoven and you kind of made him fresh again. You kind of you accentuated all those little syncopations that are in the piano part, but that we might miss unless we're really listening carefully. You really bring that out. I'm hoping that was intentional and that I'm on the right
track
there. Of course,
I think Beethoven is a modern composer.
Yeah,
he taught us all. And, he was not averse to making money. And after Wellington's victory, he wrote two sets of variations, one on God Save the King and the other on Britannia Rules the Waves. And it sold very, very well, especially in Central Europe, where they all loved the victory against Napoleon.
Yeah.
a mixed bag. But Beethoven wrote a wonderful set of seven variations, which I love to orchestrate.
Well, let's hear it now. This is a concert performance from the Toledo Symphony Orchestra, directed by Stefan Sanderling. Seven Variations on God Save the King by Beethoven, as orchestrated by Samuel Adler, here on FM 91. The Toledo Symphony in 2016, directed by Stefan Sanderling, we heard Samuel Adler's orchestration of Beethoven's Seven Variations on God Save the King. Samuel Adler has been my guest today on Afternoon Classics. He has celebrated his 90th birthday this past Sunday. We've been listening to many different recordings, talking about many different stories from his book Building Bridges with Music, which we will feature on our website. It's available at pendragonpress.com. And the new 3-CD set, One Lives But Once, a 90th birthday celebration, available from Lynn Records. You can find linrecords.com. That's L-I-N-N. It's the record of the week this week, so you can find it right off to the left of their website. Sam Adler, again, happy birthday to you. We didn't even talk about Eastman. We didn't talk about Juilliard. As you said, 90 years, hard to cover in 3 hours. So if people want the rest of the story, they can pick up the book. Right.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.